Okay, so I'm going to start with social epistemology generally. So sometimes we know about things based on our own observation, our own investigation, and then we draw a conclusion and we get knowledge that way. But obviously we can't learn very much that way, and fortunately we don't have to. We can have division of labour, where some other person goes out and does investigation, finds the evidence, draws their conclusion, gets knowledge, and becomes a comparative expert. That is somebody who just has more knowledge than us. And then we can benefit from all their work and their knowledge by finding the expert, asking them a question, something we want to know about. She can tell us the answer, the P. We trust her, trust her testimony, and then we come to know that P. So, for example, if you want to know how many moons Mars has got, you can find an expert in astronomy, ask them, and the expert will say Mars has got two moons, Phobos and Deimos. And now you know. I want to just say a little bit about a couple of aspects of this. First of all, assertion. The expert asserts that he. An assertion is a kind of speech act with a particular force, it's called assertoric force, where the content P is represented as true. It's got a particular direction of fit, that it's supposed to fit the world, and if it fits the world, then it's true. If not, it's false. So it's assessable as true. Truth assessable. And it directly conveys information at P. It may indirectly convey other information as well, but that's the direct information I'm going to be interested in here. It may, when you make an assertion, a lot of people think anyway that you express your knowledge, you express the fact that you know the P, and you're inviting the person to trust you. So that's like the response that an assertion kind of calls for, in a sense. What is trust? I take it when you trust someone's testimony that P, you take the fact that that person, S, asserted that P as evidence in favour of P. If you trust them weakly, that's evidence that you weigh up alongside other evidence you have in favour or against P. If you strongly trust them, you take the fact that they asserted that P as overriding or decisive evidence, and you just ignore all the other stuff. In that sense, they are an authority in a sort of rallying sense, if people are interested in that. Testimony may or may not be a basic source of knowledge. As many of you know, there's a big dispute about this. But in either case, there is one very important thing I want to point out, which is that evidence that the speaker is unreliable or untrustworthy or doesn't have knowledge undermines the hearer, your ability to gain knowledge from trusting them. So even if you trust them in spite of that evidence, you don't get knowledge because that evidence is undermining the justification you have for your true belief. And that's the case even if that evidence is misleading and they do in fact have knowledge. That will become important in a minute. Okay, there are two problems or difficulties in getting knowledge from testimony. Or they're rather perhaps two aspects of the same problem, I would call it. And they're both really to do with trust. So there's a problem that if you're the expert, you want to pass on your knowledge. But how does a non-expert, who by definition doesn't know the answer to the question, know that you're the expert? How can you show them that you have knowledge or prove that you're trustworthy? So how do you establish credibility? You might call this the credibility problem. And the other side of that, which is kind of better known, because people tend to put themselves in the shoes of the non-expert, is, well, which of these people who might be asserting things about P, which one do I trust? The credentials problem. How do I find the expert, the person who really has knowledge? Now, given that we get a lot of knowledge by trusting testimony, it must be possible to overcome these problems. And in fact, I think often it's relatively straightforward to do so. And that's because of these three things in the middle of the handout, that in many domains, there is an independent test of whether people are experts. For example, they can put their knowledge into a practical use that everybody can see is, you know, has worked. So if you're an astronomer, maybe you're involved in successful space exploration, or if you're an engineer, your bridge does stand up, and so on. So everyone, there's an independent test that you really did have knowledge. There may be social markers of expertise, so it may be perfectly accepted in our society that people who are professors of astronomy at certain universities are experts. So you don't need to know anything about astronomy to know those people are the experts. And there may be agreement between them. So the experts about astronomy don't disagree about how many moons Mars has got. They agree. They support each other's claims to knowledge and claims to expertise. So for those reasons, it's not impossible to, it's in fact quite easy for a non-expert to find an expert, and relatively easy for an expert to prove that she's trustworthy, show her credibility. Well, that's in general. Now we want to turn to morality. So, moral questions are difficult, and there are lots of... moral questions are difficult. It's not easy for each of us to work out the answer ourselves. We might think we would like to have, again, a division where some people go and think about the ethics of war and work out the answer, or go and get the right experiences and get knowledge that way. Then they come and tell the rest of us what the right answer is. So it seems like it would be a desirable thing to have this sort of transfer of knowledge in morality. So let's see if we can do the same sort of thing. So let's call a moral expert here, someone with moral knowledge, primarily propositional, normal propositional moral knowledge. There are other forms of moral expertise, and I will say a bit more about that later, and this might not be the only or most interesting kind of moral expertise, but for these purposes, moral expert, someone with moral knowledge, can they just tell us some moral proposition, can we trust them, and then come to know it? Well, it seems like that credibility and the credentials problem that we have in general might be even more difficult, particularly difficult for morality, for a number of reasons. So you might think, well, surely moral knowledge does have practical implications, because somebody with moral knowledge is more likely to do the right action, and then they might more likely to get admiration and other kinds of moral praise, and so on. So we have got a practical test. But of course, it's not an independent test of expertise, because to know that someone's done the right action, we have to know what the right thing to do was. And that was precisely what the non-expert didn't know. And to know that the admiration that people have got is merited, you need to know what the right action is. And that's precisely what the non-expert didn't know. So there's no independent test of expertise that the non-expert can use to identify who's got moral knowledge. There's no agreement between the people who you might think of as moral experts. There's a lot of moral disagreement. And so some of the people who claim to have knowledge, who go about saying, making confident assertions about morality, must not have. I think they all agree that some people have got false moral beliefs. As for social markers of moral expertise, I think there are some. So some people do get asked to be on committees that oversee the ethics of things that universities do, that governments do. Certain people like professors of moral philosophy, religious leaders, are those sorts of people. But that practice is very controversial. And indeed, some of the other moral philosophers don't think it's a good thing that these people, as judgment is trusted, they're the wrong people to ask. So there are no uncontroversial social markers where you can say, well, I don't know anything about ethics, but I know those are the people that society agrees have knowledge. So for those reasons, it seems to be more difficult. And I think there's an additional thing which perhaps relates a bit to what you were talking about in the last Moral Sciences Club. Some moral experts have more moral knowledge than the rest of us, I think, because they have certain kinds of experience that the rest of us haven't had. One of those sorts of experience is being a victim of certain kinds of injustice. So you have a certain harm, or if you're wrong, it's particularly salient to you that that was an injustice. So, for example, women in a patriarchal society, slaves in a slave-owning society. But these people, by being the victim of injustice, are precisely people with low social status, and one of the ways they have low social status is they lack epistemic authority. That is, people don't tend to trust what they say. So this is, again, a sort of additional problem in Anglo-Saxon, I think. Is there anything we can do about this? Well, taking the point of view of the person with knowledge, the expert here, the natural thing, I think, to do is, if you've made an assertion and people have not trusted you, who said this is wrong and they haven't listened, the natural thing to do, I think, is to try again, but louder. Do it again. Be more assertive. So you make your assertion, but with more forceful language, in a more forceful way. Shout louder, I said there. But there are two issues here, and it's going to help, I think, with one, but not with the other. The one it might help with is that one of the ways that you can lack epistemic authority is that if people just tend to ignore what you say, being more assertive can kind of get their attention. So that is going to help with that problem. But if the problem is that they're regarding you as untrustworthy or incompetent, so, for example, if men are tending to regard women as irrational, emotional, hysterical, and then you become extremely assertive, what tends to happen is they say, well, that person is being extremely irrational and hysterical and emotional, and that is exactly, in fact, what happened. When, if you look at the history of the suffragette movement, say, in the UK, it started off making the case in a relatively restrained way, nothing happened, so they started to become more militant, and then people said, well, even people who had sometimes previously supported them said that this isn't the way reasonable people behave. So this is very, of course, infuriating, that on the one hand, if you're not more aggressive, people don't listen to you, and if you are more aggressive, they regard you as untrustworthy. It seems like there's nothing you can do. But I think that's right, and I think it's in general a problem, that if you lack credibility, people don't trust you, there's very little you can do or say to get them to trust you, because they don't trust what you say. So it's a problem that's very difficult to get out of. What about the rest of us? So in a lot of the literature on this kind of epistemic injustice says, well, what we need to do is the rest of us who are being unjust need to do better. We need to treat people fairly. And I think that's obviously right. And I think it will help with some credibility about certain sorts of claim. So claims about the sort of harms you've experienced, for instance, or what it's like to be a woman in this society, are exactly the kind of things that we should give should trust when people say. But those are non-moral, though they may have implications for morality. What about really explicitly or distinctively moral claims, like women are the equal of men and they should have the vote? There, I think that all that we should do is give people the credibility that they would have had if we didn't have this kind of bias against them. And the problem there is that the general level of credibility that we should give to people about moral claims is not that high, for the reasons that I gave earlier, that there's a lot of disagreement amongst people who appear to have the right sort of experiences and have thought deeply about moral questions, and there are no social markers of who to ask. There's also, well, I think I'll leave that there. There's more I can say about that, but I'll leave that there. So the problem is not going to be easy to resolve, this problem. So credibility and credentials problem for moral experts, especially when we introduce facts about social status, are very serious and difficult to overcome. But there's also a different kind of problem that I want to discuss, which is a very different kind. It's not an epistemic problem with getting knowledge, it's a moral problem. And it's that I think, and a lot of people think, that it's not morally ideal to make your moral judgments by trusting moral testimony. There's something peculiar, I think, about asking someone what to do and then just taking what they say on trust. There's a lot of literature now about this and a lot of competing explanations for why that's so. So I'm not going to say anything general about this, I just want to give you my account of what's wrong with that. And then I want to look at, if I'm right, what follows about some, about social epistemology generally. So according to me, what's wrong with trusting moral testimony? Well, although you can get knowledge by trusting testimony in general, you can't generally get understanding that way. Understanding I think of as different from knowledge in that it involves a set of abilities or know-how that's the grasp of the reason why the claim is true. So if you understand why murder is wrong, then you have a grasp of the reasons why murder is wrong, or why women should have a vote, something like that. And I think it's important to have that set of abilities. I also think it's important to use them when you make your moral judgments. So not just having moral understanding, but using it is important. Why? Because when you do that, you are responding yourself directly to the reasons why, the moral reasons that make giving a vote to women, not killing people, the right thing to do. That's what a virtuous person would do. That also makes available to you morally worthy action, where you do the right action in response to the reasons that make it the right action. Okay, that's rather brief, but that's what I think is important. And when you trust moral testimony, you are precisely forming a judgment on the basis of reasons for thinking this person is an authority, which is not the same as the reasons normally why what they've said is true. So, the reason for thinking taken to be authority might be it's an oppressor, or it's thought about it for a long time. Reasons for thinking murder is wrong is that it's shorter life, and life is valuable, and so on. Okay, so they're very different sorts of reasons. So when you trust testimony, you are responding to really different reasons, not the reasons that make the claim true. And so if you act on that basis, you're not acting for the base on the reasons that make your action right. Okay. Suppose that's all right. It doesn't mean that you can't get moral knowledge by trusting testimony, or that it would be the wrong thing to do so in all circumstances. I also think that if you think about assertion more broadly, rather than the sort of very simple idea of someone going YP and someone saying P, but thinking of assertion in the context of making an argument, for instance, there is the possibility of passing on moral understanding as well as moral knowledge by passing on the explanation and then being able to talk through why this is right here, why what would be different in a different case. So even there, I think there is the opportunity to pass on both understanding and knowledge through testimony, through making assertions. But the trouble with making assertions is that it always leaves open the possibility of trust. And in some sense, as I said earlier, I think assertions sort of invite trust. That's kind of a natural response to them. So since we're kind of interested in ways we might pass on moral knowledge without trust, I want to look at some alternatives and see to what extent it's possible to pass on moral knowledge in ways other than using trust and using assertions. So whether that will succeed and whether it will avoid the moral problems with trusting testimony. The moral problems I see in any case with trusting testimony. Okay, and I'm going to talk about two possibilities here. One, I think, might be questioning, and the second one, the use of analogy. So, if you go to the back of your handout, you'll have it from the UFO, which is a kind of example of the sort of thing I'm talking about. So, if you think about the original model of passing on knowledge, we had the non-expert saying, is P true? And the expert saying, P is true. Here we seem to have the expert, as well, Socrates is an expert, asking a question, and Euthyphro responding. So, I can read it, you can read it yourself. So, Socrates is asking things about piety, and Euthyphro is answering, and then he gets kind of stuck. So, instead of making an assertion, the expert can ask a question. P, is P true? it's got to do, what is it to ask a question? Why is it different from making an assertion? Well, it has a different force. So the assertion has an assertoric force, this has got a different kind of force. The P, where you're asking, is P true, is not represented as true. So it doesn't have a direction of fit like assertion. I think, first of all, it has a direction of fit at all. It's not the kind of thing that's assessable as true or false. So this should hopefully make you think, but how on earth is something that doesn't convey any information at all going to pass on knowledge? How is this possible? It conveys no information. Nothing is represented as true. How on earth could this work? You might think the role of an expert asking a question is quite different. It's an important epistemic role, but it's very different. It's just like in the passage of the Euthyphro. What Socrates there is doing is helping Euthyphro make explicit some beliefs that he already has, implicitly. It's getting clear about what he really thinks about piety, and doing so, uncovering an inconsistency between them. So questioning can help you, make things clear, get things explicit, maybe uncover inconsistencies, and maybe that'll be the first step towards resolving them, and hopefully in the right, a good sort of way. But that's a pretty long way from an expert giving you some knowledge, you getting knowledge from an expert. So I do think that's an important role for questions, but I also think that questions can do more than that. And I've got three sort of ways in which it can. So the first thing is that you may not have thought about an issue at all, and the expert may just say, what do you think about killing civilians in a war? Is it ever morally acceptable to do it? And under what circumstances? And you may go and think about it as a result and think about it really well and come up with the right answer and thereby gain some knowledge. And there a question has led you to get moral knowledge. Now notice that this is a very, very different way from the way that the expert making an assertion gets you knowledge. There, the fact that the person who spoke, who made the assertion, is reliable or has knowledge themselves, has a crucial epistemic role in you getting knowledge. But the question here, doesn't have an epistemic role. The fact that you got knowledge is as a result of you doing the right kind of thinking about the question and getting the answer right. The question has a causal role in you getting knowledge, but not an epistemic one. And it's worth recalling in that context that Socrates does not present himself as an expert, and yet people still seem to do well out of answering his questions. That's obviously important. It's obviously important because follows that you don't have to find an expert to get knowledge, or know that you've got an expert to get knowledge from answering a question. So that's very important for our credentials and our credibility problem, and I'll come back to that. Okay, the second way you think, well, that's all very well, but suppose you've asked a question to you're an expert, you've asked a question like, what do you think about killing civilians in war, and they're just not doing very well thinking the right answer. Can't you help them along a bit? And it seems like there are a couple of things you might do. One is you could kind of push the answer onto them by asking a question that contains the thing you want them to end up believing as a presupposition. So I've got one example on there. Is the wrongness of intentionally bombing civilians in wartime explained by their having a right to life? Now that question looks like it's got two answers. The answer yes or no. Where the wrongness is explained by their having a right to life, or it's explained by something else. Right. In both cases, it seems like it's an assumption, it is an assumption, that bombing civilians is wrong. So if you ask a question in that form, it may well be that the non-expert starts thinking about it with that assumption made, either failing to notice it or just trusting you that that's a good assumption to make, and then goes on to think about it some more. So they kind of accepted it as a result of the way you formed your question. Now, they're not forced to accept it. They may reject it, or they may think about it and accept it on the basis of having thought about it in the right sort of way, recognising that it's true. That would be fine. But it's much more problematic, much more problematically like assertion, I think, if the person accepts it because they're trusting you that it's a good presupposition to make, or they haven't even noticed that it's made. But they think that the space of moral reasons is sort of space, possible space is kind of completely covered by the yes or no answer to that question, not noticing that there's some space they missed, as it were. So I think that is a way you could get a belief across to somebody, but it's too similar to assertion. It has the same problems, basically. But there is a third possibility, which I think is much more interesting, which is that you ask a question that has a particular form, that uses particular concepts, and therefore encourages the non-expert to use those concepts to make sense of the moral terrain, as it were, and to answer in those terms. To see how that might work, think about how you might get to think about slavery. You might ask a very general question like, what do you think about slavery, or is slavery wrong? Which would get them thinking about it. Or you could ask a question like, is on the handout, back of the handout, the slogan, the abolitionist slogan, am I not a man and a brother, said by a slave? Introducing ideas about humanity, about relation, questions like, who is my brother, that gets you thinking about it in a certain way, introduces the idea of shared humanity, the moral status that might come or not with shared humanity, the rights that might come or not with shared humanity, a certain way of conceptualising the problem makes certain things salient. Contrast that with another way you might introduce more kind of conceptual content into thinking about slavery. You might ask, and this was an interesting question at the time, I think, that abolitionism, the Wedgwood type, got going. What does the Bible say about slavery? Does the Bible condemn slavery? This was important to a lot of the abolitionists who were Christians, but it gets you thinking in a very different way to the question, are slaves humans with human rights? Different sorts of concepts, different sorts of arguments, and in the end, even if you reach the same conclusion, very different reasons for getting there. So this can be very effective. It's not guaranteed to be, but it can be. And I think, just to say a little bit about the Wedgwood campaign, I think it's interesting to compare that with what I said about suffragettes. Suffragettes kind of becoming more militant in response to basically being ignored, not being trusted. Here we see a representation of someone being less assertive, basically. Both less assertive in terms of their the type of speech they're giving, literally not making an assertion, and in terms of general demeanour, they're being very starting anyway and lacking more authority in the pose there. So both those moves can be effective.